From WKAR Studios at Michigan State University, welcome back to the second half hour of Current State. I'm WKAR Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick, catching you up on what's happening around the Capital Region and the Great Lakes. The next topic we'll discuss over the next 7 minutes may not be appropriate for some of our younger listeners. Since last weekend, Facebook and Twitter began filling up with posts using the hashtag MeToo. Thousands of women and some men have reported being sexually harassed or sexually assaulted. Morning Edition host Brooke Allen talked with an MSU professor about why the hashtag MeToo is liberating so many to speak out.
Joining us to talk about the MeToo hashtag is Dr. Christina Dejean, associate professor in the School of Criminal Justice at Michigan State University. Were you surprised it went viral?
I was and I wasn't, because I'm aware as a researcher that sexual harassment and sexual assault is pretty common in our culture, particularly among women, also among men. Occasionally when there's a big news story like this, that tends to open the floodgates. People start to feel safe about opening up with regard to their victimization, and sharing it can be very confidence building, I suppose, that just knowing you're not alone as a victim can just lead to the floodgates opening, and suddenly everyone, well, not everyone, but many people are coming forward with their victimization experiences. And so I've been surprised at the extent of it and that it's gone viral so quickly.
You had said that there were two types of sexual assault, so go ahead and explain. We've got a few minutes.
Sure.
So go ahead and explain the two types.
Sure. Well, there's sexual harassment and there's sexual assault, and it's important to kind of separate the two. Sexual harassment is something that typically happens in the workplace that can be a supervisor kind of preying on someone whom they supervise, or it can be just creating a hostile work environment, a hostile climate that can happen between any two people in the workplace. And those behaviors aren't criminal. They are illegal, according to the EEOC, that no one has to endure that kind of behavior at work, whether male or female. Sexual assault is a crime. And so that involves things like anywhere from inappropriate touching up through forcible rape. And someone like Harvey Weinstein has been accused basically of all of those behaviors. But it's important for people who are sharing and who are reading all these stories online to know that some of these behaviors are criminal and could have been reported to the police.
With me this morning is Dr. Christina Dejean, associate professor in the School of Criminal Justice. And reporting numbers, they're hard to really pin down.
They're very hard because so many people don't report when these things happen to them at the time. So one of the things that is interesting about this hashtag right now going viral, that I think it allows many more victims who perhaps didn't tell anyone what happened to them, it allows them to share now. And that can be very, very healthy for them.
So if they never shared their experience previously, and you put it out there on Facebook or Twitter, then obviously somebody's going to see that now, and that could open the door for a conversation.
Absolutely. And there are also many victims who are choosing not to share at this time, so that seeing this hashtag can be very empowering for some, but can also raise negative emotions and make it difficult for others to deal with. And so it's just important that we are sensitive to all victims and their needs and not ask questions like, well, what happened to you, if they see the Me Too hashtag. Some people are just choosing to put that hashtag up and not share details. And that's fine. If that's all they're willing to share, they shouldn't be pressed to share more. So there's a sensitivity here that I've really seen online, and I hope that people recognize that.
So you're saying if you just see the hashtag MeToo on someone's feed, just leave it alone and not say anything?
Or no, I think the best thing to say is, I support you. I'm sorry for what happened. I support you. I'm here for you if you want to talk, but not necessarily pushing to share, because that can have the negative effect. That can really push them back, especially with regard to their healing.
And especially because we don't know the story.
Exactly. Exactly. And people need to share their stories in their own time and shouldn't feel pressure to do that.
Okay, so what about the people who do comment on those Facebook feeds or Twitter and say, oh, you're just trying to get attention?
Unfortunately, that's horrible that that happens. I haven't seen any of that, but of course my feed is very restricted to my you know, friends and family. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure there has been some backlash online. I've chosen really not to seek it out because it's depressing and doesn't help anyone's situation at all. But I think that every time victims come forward, there's always backlash. And so we've seen it too with all these powerful men who have been accused. Every time victims come forward, sometimes after 20 or 30 years, then the backlash is, well, what's your motivation? Why did you wait so long? Why didn't you report it at the time? And I think the evidence of that backlash is exactly why they don't, because they know that they're going to be called out, that their character is going to be called into question, their motivations are going to be called into question. You tend to see a lot of victim blaming. And so that's why victims don't come forward. It can be very difficult.
So you did mention reporting. How has reporting changed throughout the years?
Well, I think as our awareness of what these behaviors are has increased, we've seen higher levels of reporting. So one of the things that we always watch for in criminal justice is just because something is being reported more doesn't necessarily mean it's happening more. As we become more aware of these kinds of behaviors and people are more likely to report, then of course the rates of reporting are increased pretty dramatically. One of the things that's very interesting to me in watching my own feed is the difference between the posts from my friends who are my age or older, who were working in the 70s and 80s, and the types of harassment that they dealt with in those days are different in a lot of ways than the types of harassment women today have to deal with, especially in the workplace. Because of increased awareness, because of federal law that protects employees, I don't think you hear the really bad stories that you used to hear. I always think of the Mad Men era.
Right.
You know, I think that happens much less than it used to because of this increased reporting and increased awareness.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
Thanks for listening to Current State right here on WKAR. Retail giant Amazon is looking for a second home. This could mean thousands of jobs and a new economic anchor for a city. But as Rick Pluta reports, leaders in some smaller cities, including here in Michigan, are trying to get Amazon's attention as well.
Tucson, Arizona uprooted a 21-foot-tall saguaro cactus and tried to have it delivered to Amazon's Seattle headquarters. Birmingham, Alabama constructed giant Amazon boxes and placed them all around the city.
Yeah, we're seeing all kinds of stunts.
Ron Starner is the executive vice president of Site Selection magazine. Yes, there is a magazine devoted solely to the art and the craft of choosing where to locate factories, warehouses, and world headquarters. Starner says people are getting creative as they try to land the project.
Tucson sent the cactus. The mayor of one city, and I don't recall, he actually traveled to Seattle and stood outside Amazon headquarters. There's a community here in the suburban Atlanta market that even annexed a whole bunch of land and said, look, if you come here, we'll let you call this Amazon City.
Amazon's also getting lots of videos from mayors using Amazon products to show they're ready to be team players.
I'm a proud Amazon customer. So Alexa, where is the best place for Amazon to locate its second world headquarters?
Danbury, Connecticut.
Alexa, where is the most interesting company in the world going to locate?
Obviously, Washington, D.C.
Hey, Alexa, where should Amazon locate HQ2?
In Frisco, Texas.
So what is this $100 billion company looking for? A metro area of a million or more people, access to mass transit, and proximity to an international airport, among other things. But the reality is there's probably no North American metro area that has everything Amazon's looking for, especially a ready-to-go workforce of 50,000 professionals. And so for economic developers in places like Grand Rapids, Michigan, they think they have a chance. The city is just half an hour from Lake Michigan. It boasts a walkable downtown with plenty of restaurants and brew pubs, museums, and music venues. Christopher Larson with the Grand Rapids Downtown Development Authority acknowledges the city is a long shot, but hopes the quality of life here will grab the attention of a certain Amazon CEO.
And we're hoping it's going to turn Jeff Bezos' head, and he's going to take a look at us.
But that's not all, says Birgit Close with The Right Place, a regional economic development group. She says this is a learning experience.
Just to be in the pool to us is success. We want to tell our story. We want to give Grand Rapids and West Michigan national attention by going for this.
Close says Grand Rapids can't lose by trying to win Amazon.
This is something we have to do. We owe our community that we put our best foot forward.
But their hopes are real that an online retail prince will slide a glass slipper onto that foot to make this city an economic Cinderella story. I'm Rick Pluta in Grand Rapids.
The Michigan Department of Health and Human Services recently released a plan to boost breastfeeding rates in the state. The plan includes work to get more minorities and teen mothers to nurse their babies. WKAR's Scott Pohl talks with a health expert who explains the benefits of breastfeeding babies.
Breastfeeding decreases an infant's risk of dying. So it decreases infant mortality. And that happens really in a dose-response relationship. So the more breast milk an infant receives and the longer they're breastfed, the lower that infant's chance of dying. So along with a decrease in a host of physical ailments that can happen. So formula feeding actually increases an infant's risk of gastrointestinal problems, diabetes, leukemia, allergies, asthma, ear infections, and obesity. Along with breastfeeding has positive effects for the mother. So they have a decrease in postpartum depression, breast cancer, ovarian cancer, type 2 diabetes, osteoporosis, and heart disease.
A recent report would indicate that Michigan overall has a higher breastfeeding rate than much of the country, and yet not all the news is as positive as that. Can we talk about some of those numbers?
Yes. So before 2010, Michigan was making very small gains in their breastfeeding rates, but we've recently been making great strides with an almost 2% per year increase in our breastfeeding rates. So right now, our overall rates for all mothers in Michigan are 84.1%, and that actually exceeds the Healthy People 2020 goal. But our rates among Black non-Hispanic mothers and among teen mothers are lower than we would want. And also the duration, so how long mothers breastfeed, is lower than we want. So when a baby is 3 months old, that number of moms who are still providing breast milk decreases to about 50% throughout the state.
How much do we know about those disparities in terms of what reasons there might be that fewer women of color or fewer teen mothers breastfeed?
That's an excellent question, and that's a hard question to answer. I've been really poking at that for a while now. The disparities in breastfeeding rates are reflective of health inequities. So they're really not random differences, and they're really not individual choices. They're the result of systemic conditions in our society. Women of color, unfortunately, are more likely to live in under-resourced neighborhoods, or first fruit deserts is what we call them, where they lack breastfeeding supports, such as baby-friendly hospitals, support groups, and lactation consultants. So any work that we're doing to address these disparities has to look beyond the individual to the social conditions and then the institutional or government policies and practices that discourage or support breastfeeding. We want every woman and her family to have the opportunity to make the choice to breastfeed for as long as they want to.
Tell me about what the state is doing to try to reach out to women of color and teen mothers to try to improve their rates of breastfeeding.
Mm-hmm. One of the major changes that has happened is through Michigan WIC, they have started in around 2010 a peer counselor program. And that has seen really the largest effect in terms of reaching women of color. Also, another great support is throughout the state, we have a number of local breastfeeding coalitions, and their ground level work is just amazing. They're doing lots to be a support for women within their local community.
How might you explain that Michigan has better numbers than other states?
Michigan realized that they work better when they work together. So rather than individual pockets trying to work on areas, they said, let's all do work together. So what's happening now is they're doing concentrated work within communities. So concentrated works within the city of Detroit to work on increasing the number of baby-friendly hospitals, educate WIC counselors, work with home visitors, all community providers to make sure that we're all on the same page. So no matter where moms go and who they talk to, that they're hearing the same consistent message about breastfeeding so that they're not hearing different things from different providers. That same model has moved to Flint, and is now going to be moving into the Battle Creek area. And it's our hope then to expand throughout the state. So that's really the one thing that I would say about Michigan that might be different than other states is we work extremely well collaboratively. There's not competition between groups doing the same work. We share a lot of information constantly. The one thing I wanted to mention is that we find consistently that the number one reason that Michigan mothers report that they discontinue breastfeeding or stop breastfeeding before they reach their own goals is the perception that they're not making enough milk. And we see this regardless of age or race or socioeconomic status. This is the glaring number one reason for all moms. Physiologically, only about 5% of mothers don't make enough milk to feed their babies, and yet something like 55% of moms think that that's truth. So we're working really hard to try to educate both providers and individuals and families on what is an infant's normal intake, what's an infant's normal sleeping patterns, what happens when infants cry, what are they trying to tell you? So if we can work on changing moms' misconceptions about those thoughts, I feel like that's going to help us move forward over this next hurdle that we're trying to achieve.
Michigan Department of Health and Human Services State Breastfeeding Coordinator Margie Cyril, thank you.
Thank you for inviting me. It was a pleasure to be here.
For WKAR News, I'm Scott Cole.
Back now on Current State. How many times do you look on Twitter or Facebook and find out that it's National Pizza Day or another day named after your favorite food? Or that your favorite celebrity is celebrating their birthday. Way before there was Google, a pair of brothers from Michigan compiled that information in a yearly calendar of events. WKER's Brooke Allen takes us to Ann Arbor to meet one of those brothers. She filed this story last Tuesday, October 17th, and that's important because of what you'll hear next.
One of these stars is sitting in the secret square, and the contestant who picks it first could win a prize package worth over $2,000.
Hollywood Squares premiered in 1966.
Michael Landon.
And today, rapper and musician turned actor Marshall Mathers, better known as Eminem, turns 45. Look. And 1989, at exactly 5:04 Pacific time, a 7.1 earthquake hit San Francisco.
Second base, so the Oakland A's take.
I'll tell you what, we're having an earthquake.
So, how do I know all of this? Because of this man and his passion for language.
Some people say the wheel is the greatest invention of man. I say language is the greatest.
That is former librarian, farmer, book collector, and publisher William Chase. His name may not sound familiar, but he is the man behind Chase's Calendar of Events, the ultimate go-to guide for special days, weeks, and months. So how does something so big start? It began as the brainchild for journalist and publisher, which began doing when he was just 10 years old for the neighborhood, William D. Chase and his brother Harrison.
I was the financier for it, printing in things that were necessary to get going. We operated it from the basement of the home I was living in there, wife and I and our three children. And the very first issue was called Chase's Calendar of Annual Events. This is the first one.
This is the very first one.
That's the very first one, yeah.
So it says Chase's Calendar of Annual Events, 1958, the green cover.
Right. So it'll be 60 years old next year.
And your daughter is sitting over there on the couch, and she told me that she remembered helping you this when she was 5 years old.
Oh, yes.
Right? Kathy, what was your particular job with this?
I think my main job was to stamp the mail when it came in.
Right.
Date stamp the mail. I was expert at that at age five. And I don't know if I should tell, but I'm pretty sure I started off at 35 cents an hour.
Oh, it didn't pay me well either then.
How much did these calendars sell for when you first started in 1958?
$1. $1. And next year's will be $85. If I had my druthers, it would still be $1.
So I have to ask you, what's your favorite day on the calendar?
I can't afford to have favorites. An editor of it, I felt it was very important to be impartial. And my feeling was celebration is good. The more celebration, the better. And I liked the idea of democratizing the celebration of events.
Today's edition is 752 pages and contains more than 12,500 entries. So chances are, in the coming days, you'll hear it's Marla Maple's birthday, page 530. And Be a Lover of Silence Day, that's page 607. By the way, on page 517, it says today is Mulligan Day. The definition? A day for giving yourself or another a second chance. A day for a do-over. And that is something Bill Chase says he does not need.
I've had a really wonderful life. Very thankful that I've been able to do so many things and enjoy so many things and meet so many exciting and interesting people, and that I've been able to make some little contributions of my own.
For WKAR News, I'm Brooke Allen.
January, you start the year off fine. February, you're my little Valentine. March, I'm gonna march you down the aisle. April, you're the Easter bunny when you smile. Yeah, yeah,
my heart you find. Oh, girl, you're scared sometimes. Who isn't always strong?
The voice, the late Whitney Houston, on the soundtrack of the movie she also starred in, The Bodyguard. This weekend, the stage production based on that movie is at the Wharton Center, and WKAR's Jamie Paisley talked with one of the actors in the show.
Judson Mills is Kevin Costner, or at least they play the same role. Costner was Frank Farmer, the bodyguard, in that 1992 film where Costner was the stoic foil to Whitney Houston's singer. Judson plays the same part, a semi-stoic foil to recording artist Deborah Cox, in the stage version of The Bodyguard. But why is his version of Frank Farmer semi-stoic?
On film, it's super interesting because you're right there in somebody's face and those eyes are telling the whole story. But on stage, from the fifth row or beyond, none of that's working. So my Farmer has become, I think, a little more charismatic and a little more personality and a little more physical. But I think it's necessary to keep it involved and keep people engaged.
And having that instrument right in your face.
Yes, that's right. She's the truth. Miss Deborah Cox is no joke. Trust me. Come see her at the Wharton if you don't believe me.
Is there a moment that you're like, it's coming. It's coming. She's going to belt any second.
Yeah, you know, I know her so well now, and I know her voice so well. I can tell when she's stressed or tired. I can tell when she's on her game. You know, it's amazing to listen to her voice and to her instrument and how well she maintains it and how developed and how mature her style and her. She's just a pleasure. There's not many people, around. If you get a chance to listen to her, I suggest.
I want to feel the heat with somebody.
Judson Mills co-stars in The Bodyguard, the musical, which is at the Wharton Center in East Lansing all this week. He joined the production in part because of his former college roommate, a guy who got the Oscar a couple of years ago for co-writing the script to Birdman.
Yes, Alex Dinelaris wrote what's called The Book, which is what they call the translation from a screenplay to the stage. And we were college roommates at Barry University in Miami, Florida, and used to stay up late in the theater drinking Coors Extra Gold and talking about winning Oscars and going to Broadway. And here we are 20 years later.
Were you friends with Alex and you became roommates later on, or was this randomly assigned?
Randomly assigned, yeah. We were roommates in college. We just landed and there we were. Yeah, and so we remained friends, you know, over the different time. The Oscars came along and we kind of got hooked back up again, and then this came along and they couldn't cast the bodyguard. They couldn't find anybody. So I got the call. He said, you know, the bodyguard doesn't sing. You feel like traveling? And I said, yeah, okay. And then lo and behold, there's a song, a Frank Farmer song in this thing. I felt scammed a little bit, I think. But you got to come see the show if you want to know any more about the song. It's funny, I'll tell you that.
I'm every woman, it's all in me. Anything you want done, baby.
While the national tour of The Bodyguard, the musical, which stars recording artist Deborah Cox and Judson Mills, has been touring for about a year, Mills thinks the show might soon put down roots, but not in New York City.
You know, we'd love to go to Vegas, actually. That's kind of our plan or our hope. We think that would be kind of a good fit for us. You know, I don't know if Broadway's is the spot for us. Our show and Deborah and some of the things they have going on in Vegas right now with Britney and J-Lo, and it seems like a good fit. So we'll see what happens. You know, got our fingers crossed.
Judson Mills and recording artist Deborah Cox star in The Bodyguard, which samples many hits by the late Whitney Houston. The musical is at the Wharton Center in East Lansing all this week. More info at whartoncenter.com. For WKAR, I'm Jamie Paisley.
Thank you for joining us for Current State This Weekend. I'm WKER Digital News Director Reginald Hardwick. We leave you now with more Whitney Houston. Have a great weekend.
Can't run from myself. There's no